Good morning. Boy, I got a big topic this morning, and one that's sometimes, as some would say, outside my pay grade. But do I look smart? Ready to talk about science? I got my, you know, scientific outfit on here. We're nearing the end of a series that we're calling Doubting Your Doubts. We realize that there's a lot of issues where some people, they become barriers to belief, struggles for people to find Jesus, to trust Jesus, because of different cultural and intellectual issues. And Tim Keller wrote a book called The Reason for God. That's kind of the basis of the book. A lot of you have been reading along with this, and I hope that book has challenged you. We know that it's while not a very big book, a lengthy book, it's got a lot of deep thoughts in it, a lot of things that really challenge you on a philosophical level. And for people who don't like to think philosophically, it's probably giving you a headache. But we hope that it's helped us think, because the Bible tells us that we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, with all our strength. And that does matter. And so for us to think deeply and really be challenged intellectually to wonder not just what we believe, but why, is a good thing. And so this series kind of has taken us through that idea. And this morning, we're dealing with the big question of science of the Bible. And so, you know, I've got out here, we've got kind of props with us. We got, on one side, we have my tweed coat and theology books, okay? Books that most of you look at and go, wow, that's huge. I don't want to read through that, which I don't either. I don't blame you. But theology books where people think deeply about thoughts of God, thoughts of doctrine, thoughts of the idea of the divine. And then on the other side, we have our scientific equipment, our balance, and the microscope here, and a beaker, and of course the lab coat that goes with that. And the question is, do science and religion, science and theology, do these two fields actually, are they in conflict? Can you really hold to one side and hold to the other side, or do you kind of have to choose? Do you have to choose science or religion? And this morning, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to interact with that question, but I got to be honest with you, on the level of discussing it scientifically, it's outside my pay grade. I mean, I'm just not a scientist. I am not somebody who has spent a lot of time. Now, we do have several people in our own congregation. I've had a lot of friends who follow Jesus, who believe this side wholeheartedly, who are also deeply immersed in this side. Great thinkers who could speak to it better. And there's a lot of great books and resources out there, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But what my goal is to show this morning that as if you're a follower of Jesus, it is not irrational to believe in God while still having a desire to understand the sciences and to interact with that. And then on a greater level, at the end, I really want to challenge us as Christians, if you're a follower of Jesus, to rethink some of our attitudes towards the scientific community, scientific world, and say, you know, instead of shouting at it, we ought to be involved in it. And that means that we're willing to listen and read and study. And even in the midst of this, a challenge to a lot of you in here who are parents to really think through, how should I be leading my children as they are engaging a world where there is a dominant viewpoint, okay? And so that's kind of the goal this morning. It's not hard to figure out that there are lines drawn in this discussion. All you got to do is drive down the highway, and you will start encountering, fish on the backs of cars, right? For example, first there was the Christian fish, the ichthus, over on the right there. And you've probably seen that symbol before, and then they improved it by adding a little cross, just so everybody's sure. Actually, this symbol is a good symbol. You've seen it, it actually goes back to the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries when Christians lived in persecution. This little symbol became a symbol to kind of, the cross was a dangerous sign. In a culture that understood the meaning of the cross, it was a dangerous sign for people, and Christians would begin to communicate with other believers that this was their faith by using the fish. That came from, scripture where Jesus called the first disciples to be fishers of men. And actually, the Greek word for fish, which is the word ichthus, creates an acrostic, which in the original language or in the Greek language meant, the acrostic was Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior. And so they kind of embraced the fish, but then we made nice little placards to go back on cars when everybody was driving around. And not to be outdone then, the Darwinists came up with their response, which the Christian fish sprouted legs and added the word Darwin. So of course, not to be outdone there, Christians came up with another version. And it's kind of blurry, but you've seen this, the truth eating the Darwin fish, okay? And man, we got really creative and let the world know that we are, you know, we believe in truth, not in science, and we're going to stand our ground. Well, not to be outdone, if you have an SUV with a huge thing, you can get yourself a T-Rex eating the truth fish that is eating the Darwin fish. And nice, neat little dividing lines. We have the back of our cars to show everybody what side of this argument we are on. And at the heart of it, when we raise the question, does science disprove the Bible? Okay, there are two major issues that some scientists, and I got to be very careful here to make sure I say this correctly, because science is a process. We'll talk in a little bit about the difference between science as a process and science as a philosophy. And so when I say scientists, I got to be careful because in a recent study, you know, kind of the mindset is all scientists are naturalists. They believe wholeheartedly in a godless evolutionary process. But in a recent study that was done among scientists, the question, do you believe in a God who communicates with people? Believe it or not, 40% of scientists said yes, 40% said no, and 20% said they were unsure. That's shocking. That about as many scientists believe in God as don't. So it's very easy for us to say, well, science is against theology. The truth is that it's scientists. Some scientists hold a position philosophically and build their science from that. But there's two issues that, if you're scientifically minded, begin to challenge you. And the first one is the issue of miracles. The idea that, you know, in science we can kind of explain everything is the premise that, you know, there are processes where we can explain everything, and if it can't fit into scientific explanations, it's not really possible. So a scientist would say something like, you know, virgins don't have babies. People don't rise from the dead. And you know what I think the Christian response to that is? Yeah, we agree with you. That's the point. The fact that a virgin had a baby and a man rose from the dead is supposed to be hard to believe and shock us a little bit. But in the midst of that, science cannot explain everything in this situation. And it is possible, especially if we begin with the understanding that there is a God, that God at some point in time may intervene into his creation and either use the laws that he created, the order that he created in the universe, but kind of step in and stop it and change things for his glory. And so that's one area, the idea of miracles that we, you know, people say, well, we can't believe miracles exist because miracles contradict science, and if we can't explain it scientifically, then we just really can't believe it. And then the second area is origins, creation, the you know, Big Bang / evolutionary process as compared to the approach to things like creation and the special nature of man and those sorts of things that some scientists would claim that in the end, we don't need to have a God because we can explain everything by the evolutionary and Big Bang cosmology and all those sorts of things. And so, you know, even in kids' textbooks today, you go into a public school and pick up a textbook and start reading it, and it begins with the premise, without really saying it, that God isn't needed, that the process is totally explainable through scientific process and scientific answers. And there's a little bit of a philosophy behind that. But in the end, those are the two issues that when people say, well, science has disproven the Bible, those are the two big issues that rise to the top of the discussion. Miracles and then origins, creation, those sorts of things. You know, and there's always also discussions about things like archaeology and other issues. But in the end, the big question is, are they right? Has science really disproven the Bible? Can we be rational people and believe both in science but also hold to theology, hold to the belief in God, hold to the Christian God and the belief of the Bible and those sorts of things? And what tends to happen is, you know, people with these coats show up, the scientific-minded people show up, and they raise questions. We as Christians tend to have, you know, there's probably more than this, but I can think of three real reactions that we as, I say Christians, I see in the Christian community that I actually think we need to examine. So if you're a follower of Jesus in here, we need to examine these responses. And if you're a seeker, if you're just like, you're skeptical and you're kind of like, all right, science, I kind of buy into that and I'm not sure how I can believe in that in religion. I just want to tell you that personally, I feel like some of the responses of some people who have faith, those responses have not been the best responses. And so let me give you a couple of ways I think sometimes the Christian community will respond. One is what I'm kind of calling the bubble boy, you know. We just build a barrier around us, and then we just draw to us people that we agree with, and all we'll ever read, all we'll ever interact with, the only people we'll ever talk to about these issues are people who support our position. And it's like, okay, if we can just take ourselves, and even more than that, take our kids and form a bubble, and all they ever hear about are people who just kind of believe in, you know, certain views of creation, certain ideas, and just we're going to build up all the evidence with that without ever hearing some of the critiques and arguments and some of the other position. We'll be okay. We'll stand against this. We'll keep our kids safe. And at the end, we will, you know, all come together and sing great hymns of the faith together and not ever be bothered by anything else. I think that's dangerous, and we'll get to why in a few minutes. I also think there's a response that many people have that I'm calling being a little bit schizophrenic, which means many people have learned very well how to wear the you know, secular coat on Monday through Friday, and then they know how to take that off and place it on the chair on Sunday. And while it may not be a tweed coat, they know how to put on the theology coat. And it's really almost like we end up with two approaches to life. We have, in fact, one author I read that many of us live our lives like a two-story house that doesn't have a staircase. On one story, the bottom story is the scientific, secular, working through life, just life goes on and God doesn't really influence our decisions, our attitudes, our actions. We are, in all intents and purposes, a person who embraces a certain philosophical view of life. We may never claim that, but this is the way we functionally live. And then on Sunday, we walk over here and we pick up the theology side and we say, okay, on this day, I'm going to the upper level, so the top level is the level of theology, and we go to the theological side, and we go to church, and we think about God, and we go, you know, kind of integrate that in our lives. But those two levels of life never mesh. They never mix. And so on the bottom, we have the side of what some would call provable fact, and on the top, we have the side of philosophical, theological idea. And literally, it's okay to hold contradicting views. That's not a big deal because it's just two spheres of life. And I was reading a book where it talked about this guy who was a deacon in his church, involved in a fundamentalist denomination, Bible-believing, strong in terms of certain doctrinal convictions. And he was a deacon in his church on Sunday, but his job, literally, he was an attorney who worked for a company, and his job was to do legal things where he would represent companies who his expertise was to break contracts, literally to help companies lie and be dishonest about promises and contracts that they had made. And I'm not saying there's not ever a point in time where it's ethical to look at a contract and break it, but do you feel the little bit of lack of resolve there? That on Sunday I can be a deacon, but on Monday through Friday I can help companies be dishonest and break promises that they had made. And the disconnect there. And so, kind of the second approach, you know, we have kind of being a bubble boy. We just gather people around us that are just like us. Or we have this two-tiered that on Sunday I believe this and I live this way, and on the rest of the week I kind of believe this and live this way, and we would never say it, but if we looked in our lives, that's really how we function. And then the third way is kind of being like G.I. Joe, that it's always war. That we're on one side or the other, and anytime we drive by somebody with a Darwin fish, I mean, you really want to cut them off, pull them over, and let them have it, and tell them all the reasons that their view is totally whacked out, and that you are right and they are wrong, and you want to battle. All right. I don't know about you, but that tends to be in terms of my emotional responses. This is one of the reasons I will not put a fish on my car. Because when I'm driving by yelling at somebody who has a Darwin thing, I don't want them to really know why. I also don't want to be speeding by somebody and cut them off and then they're honking at me and I, you know, like, hey, I thought that was a guy who was a Christian. He's not obeying the law. What's wrong with that guy? Anyway, that, you know, it's always a battle. And so we're, you know, if a teacher teaches evolution in a classroom, we're ready to go and fight that teacher and take it all the way to the top of the school board and do everything we can to win the war against Darwinism. And I think all these responses can be a little bit dangerous. And my ultimate challenge to you today is that maybe we ought to look at a different approach to this. And we'll look at this out of a text in a few minutes. But before we get there, I just want to make six basic statements about this topic as it relates to our understanding of science, theology, are they at war? And my answer really is they're not. But we need to be careful about what we mean by that. I think it's very healthy for us to both think theologically and scientifically and to have people who speak into the church and into culture that can do this well. And so, six statements real quick about this topic. And the first thing is the statement that all truth is ultimately God's truth. I don't believe, I hold this conviction passionately, that there is not going to be a find that causes the theology end of this, the belief in God, to crumble. That ultimately both all scientific truth and all theological truth is God's truth. And that God, literally, the reason that we are able to have a scientific approach in life is because we have a God who created an orderly world, a world that is, you know, has laws and ideas and things that work systematically because he placed them there. Those demonstrate who he is a little bit, but beyond that, that science can look at, you know, they can do experiments and come up with hypotheses and things like this because the world as it is, the world as it is created, is God's world. And if scientists look at these things honestly, when they come to conclusions, if they truly are truth, that all truth is God's truth, and it will take us back to who he is and what he's like. And so we don't have to fear that, you know, they're going to find something that will contradict that. You know, and beyond that, it means that I really believe that Christians ought to see science as a friend, not as a foe. That as discoveries are made, as things happen, as even, you know, advances in medical technology and other uses of things grow in our understanding of the world and the way it works, that at the end of the day, all truth is God's truth. And whether it's theological truth, scientific truth, all truth is God's truth. Second statement is this: we need to know the difference between science as a process and science as a philosophy. And this is where a lot of times the hard part comes, because I said we need to be clear that it's some scientists and not the big science that creates for us the issue. And science as a process means there is a scientific process, which is the idea of hypothesis and of experimentation and of conclusions and the whole scientific method that is taught in, you know, third and fourth and fifth grade and then developed on as kids develop and grow. And in that process, that the idea of looking at the world around us to figure out the order to do the good hard work of science is a really good thing. But we all also realize that in the midst of this, that there is the idea of science as a philosophy where people begin with certain assumptions and they carry that into science. And the framework, the way they see evidence, the way they interact with the scientific world is based on certain assumptions. And this can happen both with Christians and with naturalists. People who believe there is no God, that everything happened by naturalistic causes, they walk into the discussion with certain assumptions. And they never are able to get past those assumptions, and their science begins with philosophy. But the funny thing is that really neither side, but I will acknowledge, I really believe that often the naturalistic side believes that Christians start with assumptions, but they don't. And often there are scientists who begin the process with a set of assumptions, build their science from those assumptions. And those assumptions they see is ultimate science that defends everything they say, when they have made some faith-based statements that cannot be proven. I was reading through Time Magazine this week and saw they did a book review. And I don't even remember the name of the book, and it doesn't matter, but the gist of the book was this, that some guys have written a pretty lengthy treatise book on the idea of how evolution created religious belief. And their assumption, and they won't admit it, but the assumption is, well, God doesn't exist. We know that because we can prove everything by science. And therefore, we are here this morning. We hold to religion. There has to be a naturalistic explanation to why people have chosen to believe in God. And the book ultimately is going to defend the idea that people believe in God because somewhere, how many thousand years ago in human existence, that the belief in religion, belief in God was something that protected society and gathered people and gave people a certain level of control over them, which made society possible, and evolution really built that in. But there's several huge faith-based assumptions that they begin with to end with their conclusions. And here's my point. We need to recognize that science as a process is beautiful and wonderful, but science is a philosophy that everybody who comes to science comes with some of those faith-based assumptions and always kind of views things through the lenses that they have on. And we just need to be, in reality, understand that that is part of what goes on. And so when these assumptions come up, when you go to the zoo and they just have all these statements about, well, you know, how many billion years ago and this happened and that happened, and you know that they literally have begun with the assumption that God could not and is not and there is no way there's a God that is part of the equation, that is a faith assumption that they cannot prove scientifically. They can't even come close, okay? But for us to begin with the idea of an intelligent designer and that sort of thing, we also come to it with some faith-based assumptions that we can't prove, and that is science as a philosophy, okay? Which leads me to the third statement, which is there are intelligent people who see scientific evidences differently. One of the things, the criticisms often, in fact, I read a quote in a book this week that, you know, a key scientist basically said that no intelligently thinking scientists can hold on anymore to a belief in God. But the amazing thing is, as you start reading science and start interacting with people, there are tons of brilliant, super intelligent, super learned, super bright people who come to the same evidence that others would see and see evolutionary causes and Big Bang cosmology and all those sorts of things. And they would come to those things and they would come to different conclusions. And I could give you all kinds of examples. But I'll tell you one guy that we knew, that a lot of us in here knew, he had two PhDs in the sciences. He worked for Monsanto. He freaked me out because, I mean, he was in genetic biological engineering and that sort of thing. And this guy that we knew, he was like in the process of working Monsanto. He started with white cotton, right? And the goal was to take white cotton and keep changing and doing, you know, mutations in the cotton, which, like, a lot of us as Christians were like all freaked out, mutations, oh my gosh. So that they would end up with blue cotton, right? So that they would no longer have to dye stuff to make blue jeans. That we could, you know, they could just make blue jeans out of blue cotton. That's pretty cool. And when he left the project, they had gotten the cotton to green. Now, that's not something you and I could go, you know, grab some cotton, go in our backyard and come up with a way to do that. This guy was amazingly brilliant. But when he looked at some of the evidences that others would say, well, this shows that there's no God, he came to completely different conclusions, and he was way smarter than anybody else I knew in this area. Okay? So intelligent people will look at these things and come to different conclusions, and like I said, 40% of scientists say, well, yeah, we believe God is a part of this. Okay? So the next statement then is number four, we have to be okay that we may be wrong on some of the issues. We have to be okay that there may come a point in time where all truth is God's truth. We're not going to find anything that at the end says, well, there can't be a God. It's just not going to happen. And ultimately, the God of the Bible will stand, okay? And we're going to talk next week about the Ace of Spades that proves that. But at the end of the day, there may be things that we are not right on, and we have to be okay and be careful about being overly dogmatic about some of these things. Now, about 400, 500 years ago, the church took a dogmatic statement on what is called the geocentric view of the universe, which was the earth is the center, everything revolves around it. And some guys named Copernicus and Galileo, you're familiar with these names, came along and they started looking through telescopes, and they started looking at the heavens, and they came to a conclusion that it's not a geocentric, it's a heliocentric universe, that the world is at the center, the sun is the center of our universe, and we all revolve around the sun. And people started, you know, some theologians, some people on this side, they drew a very stern line. The amazing thing is both Copernicus and Galileo were Christians. But Copernicus was excommunicated. They brought Galileo in and stood him before a tribunal and forced him at the end of a sword to recant his views that he knew were right. And then they put him in prison for like 15 years for saying, nope, the world, the earth is not the center, the sun's the center. Well, we know now that the church, pulling a couple proof texts out of the Bible, came to some conclusions that just weren't right. But Christianity did not crumble. You know, some of the texts that some of the theologians went to were places in the scripture where it talked about the sun rising and the sun setting. Well, we know, we still use that language. I mean, nobody who says, you know, the other morning I went waterfowl hunting. That's one of the things I love to do. And we found the sunrise time. Okay, literally, we went to NASA's website and found the, and on NASA's website, it is called the sunrise table. But nobody in their right mind really believes that that language means that the sun literally is rising. We know the sun's fixed, it's the world that's spinning, but our appearances, the way we see the world, it looks like the sun's rising. That's all the Bible was doing, but boy, some of the, you know, 500 years ago or 400 years ago, they took those texts and they said, well, Christianity has got to believe this. Well, they were wrong. We've got to be okay that there may be some things that force us to interact and rethink and struggle with some of these issues. But I also want to tell you, I don't for a moment believe that the end result is going to be that Christianity itself won't be true. All right, next statement number five, we need to learn, therefore, to hold our views on secondary issues loosely. Here's what I mean by this. That in the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3 tell us the story of creation. And we come to that, and I imagine even in this room, there are multiple views on what that means. For people who kind of have thought through the theological end, who've done some study, or maybe you've just sat in a Sunday school class and you've read through and had somebody teach you that the Bible is created in 6 days in Genesis 1, and then Genesis 2 gives some stuff. And what I'm trying to say, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into the different views. But what I will say to you is that we come to this and we have beliefs that are based on our study of scripture and our understanding of science. But I really believe that what needs to happen among the Christians in Christianity is we need to learn how to hold on to these, what I would consider a secondary issue, loosely. Meaning, is it six literal days or six figurative days or six ages, or is the whole picture a orderly account that's more rhythmic and poetic, and it's really not picturing days at all, but it's picturing, there's all these different ideas out there. And what's happened over the last 40 years in Christianity, this end of the study and this discussion, is that instead of having real conversations over here, the Christian, the theological side just keeps arguing over what is secondary. And let me tell you what I can tell you for sure about Genesis 1 and 2. Genesis 1 and 2 is not necessarily, I don't think it's necessarily telling us how, and this is where most of us argue is how, but I can tell you that Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is very clearly telling us who and why. Those are the questions Genesis 1, 2, and 3 are trying to answer. Who, meaning in the beginning God, and why that God created and it's good and he created humanity in his image. These are statements of why. And instead of getting, I mean, I think it's cool to do the study and have nice coffee discussions about the how questions, both from theology and science. But I believe people who get the who and the why right, at the end of the day, if they differ on the how issues, we can have good Starbucks conversations. At the end of the day, we need to link arms and walk out of the room and be on mission together and not divide over that. Now, I believe that wholeheartedly. And here at Genesis, the who and the why of creation is a closed-handed issue. The how, the different views of creation, we are very open-handed. And we think it's good to have good, hearty theological discussion about these things. But at the end of the day, we believe we're going to link arms and go out together. But I actually believe the Christian church needs to rethink some of these arguments that are going on in the theological world about the different interpretations. And we need to learn how to engage the conversation back to the rest of culture, all right? So the last statement is this: then we've got to figure out how to get upstream rather than screaming at the river as it goes by. And you're like, what? Where's that come from? And here's what I mean by this. And this is actually not original. This has been in a couple books recently. That what's happened in the Christian world when it comes to culture as a whole. And this includes looking at scientific world and Christians involved in scientific world. This involves the cultural world and things like movies and TV shows. And it involves just all this stuff, our schools and all this kind of stuff. The Christian kind of way is to watch culture as a river that's going downstream, okay? So here's this river that's flowing. And what Christians are doing is they're standing on the bank screaming at the river as it goes by. And that's our response to culture. And so we're standing on the bank screaming at the river as it goes by. And I actually really believe that what needs to happen is that we as followers of Jesus, if that's who you are, we need to stop screaming at the river as it goes by. And we need to start thinking about how we as people of faith can send people upstream so they begin to shape the flow of the river. And this is what needs to happen. And there's a lot of writing that are coming out, a lot of books that are coming out right now about the fact that this is what needs to happen. And my challenge today for us is that we do live in a culture that is dominantly controlled, even by on the philosophical level, scientifically, by naturalistic explanations. You know, your kids are going to go to school, and when they take world history, their world history book, chapter one, is going to be a bunch of historical ideas that are based on faith-based assumptions that God didn't start it. They have no proof about that. Literally, the first full chapter of their history book about what was really taking place, but they make assumptions based on a naturalistic evolutionary view, and they start world history by telling us how humans evolved to this point, and it came out here, and these people. And we live in a world that is dominated. You go to the zoo and it's everywhere. But instead of being people who are standing at the bank screaming at the river, we need to learn how to be people who start sending ourselves. And more importantly, if you're a parent here, we need to start figuring how to prepare our kids to be people who go upstream and shape the stream. This is why I think it's imperative that we need to help teenagers and our children as they grow up in our homes find God's call in their life. And see, God's purpose in their life is so much bigger than just their own life. But they are to live as people who are living out the mission of God in their culture. And that they go away to school prepared. They go away to college prepared to have an all-encompassing worldview that they both can defend, but they also can interact with people who are different from them. And they're not screaming at the river. They're in the river shaping it. Does that analogy make sense to you? And so what I want to do is I want to show you a story from the Bible real quick about somebody who did that. A guy named Daniel, who his story is that he was ripped from his own country. He was placed in a foreign place that they tried to indoctrinate them and kind of brainwash them into believing the idolatry and the images and the beliefs of the culture of Babylon. And here's Daniel and these three other guys that are his friends in the midst of this, and they were about 14 years old, and the end result was they were in the culture, but rather than just freaking out and going into a bubble, and rather than being, it's all a war, and rather than just kind of melting down or not knowing how to interact with it, and rather than creating a two-tiered view, these four guys became young men and then men who lived the convictions of their worldview while they influenced the culture, the foreign culture that they lived in, okay? So if you have your Bible, flip over to the book of Daniel, chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. If you have a Bible, if you don't have a Bible in any rows, there's Bibles for you, page 624 in those Bibles. And I'm just going to be real quick, but I just want to read through the story and make a couple points real fast about this idea, okay? So Daniel chapter 1. And... We'll begin with verse 1. I'll just read it real fast. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands and some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both the royal family and of nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Now, here's what happens. Babylon, who the king is Nebuchadnezzar, conquers Israel, conquers Jerusalem and Judah, God's people, the Hebrew people, and they are victorious. And the way that the Babylonians ruled was to deport people, and especially the best and brightest. And so they came in, they basically took all the kids that would have gone to Ivy League, to military academies, they took the best and brightest of the young people, and they brought them back to Babylon. They deported them close to 1,000 miles away from their home, and this is not a day where you could hop on an airplane and just zip home. I mean, it is a total transference of people from their culture to a different culture, ripped from Jerusalem, their home, and they're taken to Babylon, this foreign country, and they're placed now in the institutions of learning, the higher education. They're going to be taught, but there's a little bit even in this text of the idea that what Babylon wants to do is deprogram and reprogram them. They want to take the best and brightest of these Jewish Hebrew kids who believed in one God and bring them to Babylon and help them think and become Babylonian in their thinking. Which Babylon had all kinds of gods, their literature was pretty deluxe, and so they want them to bring these young men, and they're going to reprogram, retrain them to think like Babylonians. Now, I'm not going to belabor this, but I will tell you that there's a lot of in colleges and universities today, this same thing. What we're going to do is we're going to take kids who grew up in this culture and that culture, with this religion, that religion. We're going to get them on a college campus, and we're going to deprogram them and reprogram them. That is out there, okay? But how did they interact with this? Well, let's keep reading. The king assigned them daily portion of food that the king ate and the wine that he drank, and they were to be educated for 3 years. At the end of time, they were to stand before the king. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. He called Daniel Belshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. So they come and they are actually given new names. And if you do a little bit of a textual study, the old names, their Hebrew names, all have some kind of worship towards the one God, the God of Israel. Like the name Daniel means God is the judge. But the new names they are given all bow to the gods of Babylon. So their names are changed. It's not just they got new names. It's that we are going to tell you, you have a different God, a different set of beliefs, a different approach to life. What's interesting in the text is that here in the story, they're never called by their Babylonian names. In the text, they just keep using their Hebrew names. Verse 8, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord and the king who assigned you your food and your drink. For why should you see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. So Daniel says, listen, we're not going to eat the king's food. I'll get into why for a minute. Give us vegetables, okay? And the leader says, listen, you're putting my head in danger here. If I give in to your requests and, 3 months from now, you're scrawny and you're not thinking straight because your diet is not the best, off of my head because I gave in to you. And so Daniel gives him a way out. He says, verse 9, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord and the king who assigned your food and drink. All right, I read that. Verse 11, then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then our appearance will be as the youths who eat the king's food, be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in the flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So the idea was, let's try it for 10 days. And after 10 days, if it works out, let's stick with it. And after 10 days, God gave them favor. They looked better. They were thinking clearer than the people who were eating the king's food. And so they just continued this to honor what Daniel had requested. Verse 17, with these four youths, God gave them learning and skill and literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the time when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. Do you hear that? They got upstream. They weren't yelling at the Babylonian cultures that went by. All of a sudden, these four guys who lived out God's purpose in their life and God's the worldview that they held end up with the king influencing culture. And much of the rest of this book was the opportunity that primarily Daniel, but also these other three guys had to speak into the thought process, the ideas of the king that got upstream. Verse 20, in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. All right, here's the big picture. Daniel gives us a picture of somebody, and these other three guys give us a picture of what I think needs to happen among especially our young people, your kids, but even with us a little bit, as we need to figure out what it looks like to live the worldview of the scriptures in a culture that really in some places wants to deprogram that. But we need to figure out how to live that way so that we are become influencers of that culture. And how do we do that? And just two things really fast. The first thing is this, that if that's going to happen, we need an all-encompassing worldview. We need to understand who the God of the Bible is. We need to study. We need to learn. We need to figure out what the scriptures teach us and understand the one God of the Bible revealed in three persons, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, the story of the gospel, and that needs to shape us in every area of our lives. So let's talk real quick, what is a worldview? And a worldview is, in the simplest way, it's the way we see the world. But a worldview always answers four basic questions. It answers the question, how did we get here? What the heck is wrong with this place? I mean, is there anybody who would disagree with the fact that there are issues and this world is not really as it should be? So a worldview answers, what's wrong? How do we fix it? And where are we going? A worldview answers those four questions. Naturalism, evolutionary process ends up having four answers to that. Let me be careful here. I just threw out a phrase I didn't mean to. I said evolutionary process. I don't mean that. Like, I think we need a dialogue even about the idea that on some levels evolution does happen, okay? Now, I just threw out a can of words. I don't have time to open this morning. But because I misspoke just before, I don't want to sound like I'm anti-totally evolution. Evolution does take place on some levels. And some of the debate and some of the discussion that we need to figure out as we try to hold both of these is how much and where does that take place and how does that shape who we are, okay? So naturalism has answers to those four questions. In Christianity, as a follower of Jesus, so do we. The Christian story, the big overarching story that tells our worldview is the story of creation, fall, redemption, restoration, okay? This is our worldview, that God created all that is, that whatever how he did it, that God created, he created out of nothing, that God is the uncaused cause. He has existed for, you know, all eternity, and even that phrase is hard for us to fathom because time is part of creation. But God is the one who existed when there was nothing. And from nothing, God created all. And out of that, that it is his creation, that his declaration of the creation was that it was good and that it was meaningful and purposeful. And the how did we get here is that God created. But what's wrong is the question of fall, the fact that things are twisted and broken because humans chose to rebel against their creation, their creator, and live for their own glory and live as the center of their own universe, to live for themselves, to put their own lives, their own purpose, their own meaning above the purpose and meaning of God. And because of that the world is twisted and broken because of human sinfulness. All right? And the answer to how is it fixed is that we cannot fix it. But that God has stepped in the person of Jesus, and Jesus gave his life to offer redemption. And that Jesus' death on the cross is sufficient to change all of our lives, to bring us back into a right relationship with our Creator, and that redemption both in the present is found in trusting Jesus, and in the future, as we trust Jesus, that God will eventually bring everything back to where it was before the fall, which is the story of restoration. That there's going to be a new heaven, a new earth, that God is going to renew everything and make it right. Okay? That's the overarching Christian story. And the question that we need to wrestle with is, first of all, how do we make sure we deeply understand that story and pass it on to our kids? Because they are being influenced by worldviews. Now, I don't believe the answer is to run away from the other people speaking into it. I believe we need to teach our children and teach ourselves how to be critical thinkers. And this is what happens with Daniel. Daniel's place in this culture. There are four names listed, but there are way more than four Jewish boys who show up in Babylon. But four of them look at the culture, and instead of running into the bubble, instead of creating a two-tiered view, instead of making it a fight, they begin to wrestle with how do we integrate our belief in the one God that has given us the covenants and the law and all these things in the Old Testament, how do we integrate that into our life? And one of the things they saw right away is as the king began feeding them the best food in the house, it's very possible that they would, without even knowing it, begin to break the laws that God had given the Jewish people about their dietary laws. And that they would be served food that was sacrificed to the gods of the Babylonians. And they said, listen, we are not going to defile ourselves, meaning that we are going to maintain our distinctiveness as people who live for the one God. And the way they went about it said, listen, we realize that we need to honor God while living here. And for them, the way to say, they said, do this, feed us vegetables and water rather than steak and better than that, ribs. Because you understand, you know, in Jewish culture, God's law told the Jews not to eat pork. Now, I'm not going to chase that. Why? There's a lot of reasons why, but the laws included don't eat pork, don't eat things like fish with no scales, like catfish. And the reality was is that if they just started eating the king's food, they were going to have foods that were set before them. Someday they were going to get a rack of ribs, okay? And they would violate their worldview, their trust in this one God and what it meant to serve and honor him in their lives. And basically what happens is everybody else who shows up goes, we're here, we need to live like Babylonians and get over it. And they say, nope, the worldview, our belief in God needs to shape who we are in this culture, all right? And they had an all-encompassing worldview. So as Christians, I think what this speaks in our lives is, first of all, if you are in the workforce, if you are a student in school, wherever you are in your life, how does the story of creation, fall, redemption, restoration speak into the secular setting that you are in? How do you live like those realities are true every day? All right? This all-encompassing worldview. But the second thing I will tell you that comes out of this is that we need to find ways to live our worldview as agents of restoration in the culture. In other words, that God is making all things new, and when we become followers of Jesus, we are part of that story, which means that whether I am a pastor, which is what I do, or you are a school teacher, or you are a scientist, or you are a physician, or whatever it is that you do, a dock worker, you are doing that for the glory of God, but doing it in such a way, not that you're yelling at the culture, but you are shaping and interacting with the culture in which you live. And what I really believe this means is that we ought to be challenging our children to live for the glory of God, but do it in such a way that they begin to get upstream, which means that when evolution is taught, we shouldn't scream at teachers for teaching it. We ought to be helping our kids to stand against it, but begin to teach them what it looks like to have good, solid conversations and to be brilliant, bright people. And this is what happens with Daniel, okay? They're probably about 14 years old when all this takes place. based on the language of the text, the word youths in here, it usually talks about somebody up to about the age of 14 years old. So we're talking middle schoolers. Show up in Babylon, but they know how to learn the stuff of the Babylonians. Don't miss that they went and they studied Babylonian culture and literature and science. But they were able to do it in such a way that they maintained their distinctiveness as people who believed in God. And as they did that, God gave them favor, and they ended up right next to the king. And this ought to be our goal. This ought to be what we hope for our teenagers. Listen, you guys, don't just live a life where you just kind of go about your life and one day believe in God and next day believe. Live for the glory of God. Figure out what it means for you to be a culture shaper. And if it's in, whether it's in music or science or teaching or whatever it is, shape culture. Get upstream. Parents, challenge your kids to be critical thinkers and help them figure out what this looks like. And ultimately, that's what happens in this text. Several things take place. They decided Babylon wasn't an enemy. They didn't fight Babylon. They became learners in the culture. They saw participation in the culture as an extension of their call, meaning that they realized that God put them on this planet for something bigger than just vegetables or beef. They were here for something much bigger than that. Live like that matters. And then they also, as a result, they found that God gave them favor. And our challenge this morning, as we think science, and you know, I don't have all the answers. I will tell you there's a lot of great books and great materials this week on the blog. I'll post some books that I think speak into this issue well. But at the end of the day, I think we need to see that these are not foes, but the goal is on this issue and any other cultural issue, we need to figure out in as Christians and you know, both here, us at Genesis here in Eureka, but really Christianity as a whole. We need to figure out how to quit being people who stand on the bank screaming at the river when it goes by. And we need to start doing everything we can to send people upstream, to shape the flow. And I hope this isn't too ethereal and that illustration isn't weird for you. I hope it makes sense. And so just my closing, and I've kind of hit on this both ways, but my closing challenge is to you who are parents. I don't care how old your kids are. You can start helping shape their worldview. Don't just let it be shaped by anybody and everybody else. We at Genesis are helping, but listen, at the end of the day, the church's job is to support parents and what they are called to do, not to take the job over for you. And if your kid, if all you do is send your kids to church and hope they will get enough stuff from us, they're gonna end up, statistics tell us about 80% of Christian students who leave Bible-believing churches, they go away to college, about 80% during their college years are walking away from their faith. And I actually believe the biggest reason that's happening is that they are going to a place where they're being indoctrinated and they don't know how to hold on to their worldview in the midst of it. So shape that worldview because you can hold on to it and be an intelligent person, believe me. But you help shape that. No matter, I mean, even if they're three, you can start talking, speaking into that. As they get to be teenagers, read some stuff with them. Read this book we just finished and talk. And I know it gives you some of, you know, it can give us a headache, but it can be a really good book to help them think about these issues, okay? Work through that, all right? And that's my challenge today. We give you a chance to ask questions and we'll see if we got any and I'll answer a couple questions and we'll worship and do communion and all that kind of stuff. So is it logical to assume that the flood wiped out dinosaurs? that's one theory. And here's what I'll say to you, is that the discussion of just dinosaurs into the biblical story for a lot of people ends up being a real struggle, especially if people are young earth creationists. And that becomes one explanation to why dinosaurs exist and then they were gone. I will tell you that even among Christian people, that's not the only explanation. And at the end of the day, this is one of those issues that I think that we need to study, we need to examine the different viewpoints, and then we need to hold the position we hold pretty loosely. But I will tell you that just the fact that there were dinosaurs that were here and then not here is not proof that God doesn't exist. It's a lousy, flimsy argument. And it's also pretty dumb to believe that, you know, that like there weren't really dinosaurs, or come up with weird views. Like there was one guy I heard speaking on this issue found a coloring page with Jesus riding a dinosaur. They like your kids would go to Sunday school, and if they talked about creation and dinosaurs, here's Jesus with, you know, T-Rex and a, you know, saddle riding. Really? And so I think, you know, it's one of the answers to the question, and it may be a good answer, and I'm not a scientist, so I can't be definitive on why it's good or why it's not. Study it, interact with it. It's an answer, but it's not the only answer. It's also not the only answer that as Christians we need to hold to, and it doesn't unravel our faith if that's not the solution, okay? Next thing. Any others? Is it possible for God to have created evolution? I would say it's not possible. I would say it is true. Now, I know some of you, that makes it really uncomfortable, but I started by saying there is evolution that does, or I didn't start, I mentioned this, there is evolution that takes place. Whether you want to call it micro versus macro or however you want to label it, there are places where species change and adapt based on certain situations and criteria and different natural forces and things like that. What I would say is that God created beings so that they could survive on the planet. And that adaptation is a good thing. The question is not whether or not things evolve. The question is how far does that evolution go? Okay? I also tell you that Christians differ on the answer to that question. How far does that evolution go? Once again, hearty discussions about that are good. But I would say not only is it possible, I think God created the ability to adapt in species. I mean, it's part of his creation. Is that it, or we got another one? All right, here's a good last one. Does God object to cloning? There's not a chapter and verse. You know, Psalm 14:3, thou shalt not clone. But what happens in our today culture is that we struggle with the reality that there are all kinds of ethical issues that are raised by advances in science. Personally, I think this is a really, really dangerous one. And pretty much any time we end up in areas where we are trying to become the God, you know, that there's going to end up being major ethical issues. But once again, it's hard to answer and hard to interact with where are those lines. And there's all kinds of books out being written out there by, once again, brilliant people on scientific ethics and medical ethics and how do we bring a Christian worldview into realms of science and things like that and find where we both live like Daniel did. All right? So, three good questions. Band's going to come out here, and then we're going to do a few other things. We're going to celebrate communion here in a minute and all that stuff. So come sing. Stand with us. We're going to worship. I'm going to pray, and we're going to worship Jesus for a few minutes. All right? Lord, we love you. We praise you. We thank you that you are creator. And Lord, this is a hard question, but I just pray that as we even interact with it this morning, you'll help us to realize that all truth is God's truth and that you are there. In your name we pray. Amen.